we are running on this show. And I'm going to have a little piece of it as my respects towards Bill. The day after Bill died, Monday a week ago, I got a phone call from the fellow I'm going to introduce, saying that he had died the day before. He'd been in contact with New York that day. This chap that I'm going to introduce, I remember quite clearly. 30 years ago, in VC Street, our first New York office, in a room, I'd say 12 by 12, with one secretary, Ruth Hawk, and Bill as sort of handyman, and this little fellow sitting in the back, quiet as a mouse. And I was introduced to him. And I found out he was itinerant bookkeeper. One of those guys that picks up books here and yon, anything for a buck. Well, we were very glad to have a bookkeeper at that time, so Bill told us, to keep a record of our losses and who we owed money to. Because when he started taking over the books, we were $20,000 in the hole and no assets. And the book had been out, this is the end of 1940. The book had been out about 18 months. So since that time, this chap has been very, very close to Bill in the office and outside, living not far from him, up in Westchester. And I thought it was a terrific opportunity to have him come down and give us his personal vision of Bill over these 30 years. Because he's been keeping the books ever since, and he soon became a CPA, not an itinerant bookkeeper, and he's done a remarkable job. So I'd like to introduce Wilbur Smith.
Thank you, Jim. My name is Wilbur Smith, familiarly known as Burr Smith, and I am an alcoholic. I come from the Chappaqua group in Westchester County, which is about 10 or 15 miles from Bedford Hills, where Bill and Lois live. My advent to AA came in the first meeting in New York in September of 1940. And I continued on my merry way for a while. And the last drink I had, I think, was on Saturday following Thanksgiving Day of 1940. I seem to remember that in those days, Mr. Roosevelt, the president, had given us two Thanksgiving days, so I never bothered to go back to find out which one it was. It has seemed to me that Thanksgiving Day was a very appropriate time for a drunk to celebrate the beginning of his sobriety, and if they moved it up to July, I would still celebrate on Thanksgiving Day. When I came into AA and in the meetings in New York, and as Jimmy said, pretty soon I was called over to the office there to assist in the bookkeeping functions. Jimmy asserts abilities that I don't have. As a bookkeeper, I'm lousy, but I was in the accounting business there and public accounting, and I was able to set up some records and methods and systems that were of help. And as Jimmy pointed out, Bill was, he was there, and Ruth Hawk was doing most of the work. There was another gal there that was shipping out the few books that were being sold. And principal concern of Bill at this point was the spread of AA, spreading the word, what this thing could do for the suffering alcoholic. A few months thereafter came the Saturday Evening Post article by Jack Alexander, which brought into the office a tremendous number of inquiries as to where was AA and how did we find it and what do I do with my poor sick husband and all the rest of it. In any case, it required a whole lot of people to answer these inquiries. There were volunteers from New York and the New York area that stepped in and got these letters answered. Shortly thereafter, they had to have more help in the office, and there wasn't money. And I can remember Bill being worried at this point and finally consulting with the then elders around there and saying, well, if we put the arm on the movement and send out an appeal for funds and ask them for a dollar apiece, maybe we can get enough to get through till next fall when we'll put the arm on them again. So this was done, and then came the first appeal for funds for the purpose of paying the office expenses there. The office expenses at that time related to the answering of these letters about AA and the relationships with the groups. This was Bill's concern at that time. Very shortly, he began to consider the relationships with the groups. Groups were springing up all over the place, and many of the groups didn't know how to operate. They had to write in for counsel and advice, and Bill was concerned with this area. As the movement grew, and as the experience in these groups, in the formation and operation of groups, became available to New York, the answers that came from that, the answers to the inquiries from new groups became a little more helpful and a little more secure. I think that the next thing that concerned Bill after the expansion in the number of groups was how were we going to be able to keep these groups together. After all, this Bill in New York and Dr. Bob in Akron could not control these people. The office had never tried to control them. They just offered suggestions as to the experience in the groups in other areas, and this had been found successful, and that method had been found unsuccessful. But they had no mechanism yet to determine any sort of uniformity in the behavior of the people within the groups. This study and consideration by Bill and by others with whom he counseled continued for a couple of 3 years and resulted ultimately in the 12 traditions. Now, the 12 traditions are not a command from heaven. They are simply guidelines on which the groups model their behavior. If they get out of line, they've got to account for it either to themselves or to other groups which may question them. And it's up to them to know the hows and the whys and the wherefores. With the acceptance of the 12 traditions, Bill's next great concern was the whole structure of AA. You have to remember about this man that he spent probably 18 hours a day, 16, 14, whatever number, thinking mostly about AA. How it could be developed, where it would go, what was its future, and how it was all coming out. As I say, his next step here was in trying to form the General Service Conference. He insisted, as somebody has said, that it was unfair and illogical to expect Dr. Baum and Bill to carry the responsibility forever. They couldn't answer to it, and they had to be replaced. And the proper location of this responsibility was in the movement, which would elect representatives to go to New York. These representatives, in turn, would set up a board of trustees who would control and determine the policies for the pending year under which that office would perform. This was not an easy task that Bill undertook, because he was too far ahead of the people he was talking to. The then trustees in New York couldn't see it. The alcoholic trustees were fearful of politics and all sorts of things. And the non-alcoholic trustees didn't all understand what was going on. In any case, this was a battle that went on for a couple of years. Finally, through the great efforts of Bernard Smith, who was a non-alcoholic attorney on the Board of Trustees, the board was persuaded to start and try this General Service Conference idea on a trial basis. It was tried out and was found successful and has been incorporated now into the whole structure. I think myself, I sat in these conference meetings for a number of years, more as an observer. In the beginning, I used to submit financial reports and explain those to the delegates and answer any questions about the financial reports. But I sat there watching these delegates operate in those conference meetings. This went on in those days for, I think, 3 or 4 or 5 days, something like that. And by the time I got home, after that conference was over, I was just wrung out emotionally. These people took me apart. They are devoted. They understand what's going on. Their grasp of the spiritual principles involved in AA and in the ways that the conference uses in making decisions much more than any of those trustees who were hassling over this thing could ever imagine. My own feeling, personal feeling, is that the conference has been a wonderful thing for AA. And it took a big load off of Bill's back. From there on, Bill was more concerned with various structural problems around the office there and in the Board of Trustees. He agitated for some time to change the trustee ratio. You may or may not remember that originally there had to be a majority of non-alcoholics on this Board of Trustees. Bill's contention was that by now we should have reached maturity and we should be able to handle our own affairs, that he and the movement were very grateful to all of these non-alcoholic trustees who had devoted their time and energy and thought to the welfare of AA over the years. But then he thought from here on the ratio should change. Finally, some years back, this change was made by the conference and the guidelines are set up so that there will be from here on, I believe, a majority of alcoholic members over the non-AA members. So much for what Bill has been doing over the years. As a man, he was a wonderful guy. He was a big, tall, lanky, gangly Vermonter. I can remember in the fall or the winter of 1941, I guess, he and his dear wife, Lois, were up at our house to spend the weekend, and Bill wanted to go up to Bedford Hills and see a house up there that some friend had told him about that might be available for sale. So he had come out for this purpose, and we took off for Bedford Hills. That's, I say, 10, 15 miles up the line. And we finally located this place, and Bill at this point, discovered that he had neglected to bring the key to the house, which he had been entrusted with. So he and I took a trip up the hill, and we looked around, and we didn't think much of the locks on the windows, and finally we went through a screen and into the interior of this house. Then we went back and got my wife and Lois and I think Ruth Judson or somebody, and we all went through the house. This was a great big barn of a place as far as I could see. It had been built as a summer place. There were a few beat-up wicker chairs laying around there. There was a few tennis shoes and tennis rackets and stuff like this laying in closets. But other than that, it was pretty bare. And in November, December, it was mighty cold. And anyway, we looked it all over and got in the car and went on back. Well, from the time we got back home on Saturday afternoon until the time Bill and Lois left to go back to New York on Sunday afternoon, I don't think Bill thought or spoke of anything other than that house. We had a fireplace in our house, and Bill was stretched out there, all 6 or 7 feet of him, on the floor, thinking. And every now and then, he would come up. He says, "Barry, do you think we could put a furnace in that house?" I said, "Oh, where the hell you're going to put a furnace in that house?" I said, "It goes down this way, and you got a little cellar in the middle." So that would quiet him down for an hour, and then he would come. "How about if we cut a hole in the floor there and we put a pipeless furnace down under here and we heat the house that way?" I said, "Fine, where does the smoke go out?" "Oh," he says, "we can take that over about 20 feet and put it up through the chimney." Going up there. Anyway, he was the type of guy who would concentrate on something like this. And all of the conversation or whatever was going on around him would not be heard at all. Well, sometime in, I guess, 42, maybe 43, I don't know, they moved into this house. They bought it. And like I say, while I called it a barn to start with, it is a marvelous place now. It's equipped with all kinds of antique furniture. Upstairs, it's full of the memorabilia that they have collected over the years from various conventions and places they've been, and pictures and books by the thousands. And it's altogether a very lovely place. Getting back to Bill, as I said, he was a big, long, gangly Vermonter. He had a terrific sense of humor. And to get him talking and joking about the old days before I got in there, when Dr. Bob Smith and Ann Smith and those old people from Akron around there would keep my wife and I in stitches for weeks. But Bill, on the other hand, as they say, did nothing that I could see but think about AA and its future and how it could be protected and how the various things that might happen to it could be prevented. He read a great deal in history, in psychology, in the histories of various religious groups. You remember the Washingtonian group? He read all he could find about that and what happened to him and what happened to so many others. And always, he was thinking of AA. As I say, he was a studious man. He was a very kind person. He was helpful to individuals. After Bill and Lois moved in, the Stepping Stones up there in Bedford Hills, the AA members used to flock in there. I don't know how they took care of all the people they did, but there would be, in some cases, old friends who were having trouble. In other cases, they would be visiting an anonymi from San Diego or Keokuk or wherever they were coming from. He was always happy to see them all. And with it all, he was kind. He was generous. The greatest attribute of the man, I think, was his persistence and the way he would hang on to an idea and keep pounding on it till he was finally able to persuade somebody. The argument that I told you about over the starting of the General Service Conference was one demonstration of him. In all of the discussions that I witnessed, I never saw Bill lose his temper. I never saw him get so angry that he would flare out. I've seen him beat on the table and thump hard to get his points home. But I never saw him so angry that he lost his control. In my view, he was a wonderful man. Likewise, I agree with our leader here tonight that the monument to Bill will, of necessity, be Alcoholics Anonymous. And if we all follow the guidelines that have been set forth for us in the 12 steps and in the 12 traditions, I'm sure that Bill's monument will be here a long time. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. From my own experience, I would underscore those comments as to Bill's tenacity and his dedication to a thought regarding AA. At the conference last year, we used to share Bill at lunch. He would sort of go from one table to another. And I believe it was on Tuesday that Bill suddenly got a thought, just as he had some chocolate ice cream halfway from bowl to lip. And as he expressed his thought and carried it through, the ice cream dripped. It dripped right down onto the arm of his coat, and he never noticed it. And you know, it was there all week. It was there all week. But some of his recollections of Bill, the history of AA, which is the story of Bill, would call upon, again, upon Jim B. I'm Jim Burwell again. I was glad that you folks had had a chance to hear Burr give a little personal side of Bill up in New York. What I'd like to do is add a little bit what I saw in the days before the book and what I knew was pretty authentic of his recovery. Of course, a lot of this is in the AA history, but even a lot of that was glossed over by Bill, because Bill was in the ivory tower all the time. We were down there on the firing line. And it was pretty hard for him to see. Or it was pretty hard for him to have confidence in us, individually and across the country, like some of us had the opportunity to do. Because you see, I was one of the early members. I came in January 38. I had my last drink 5 months later. So when I met Bill in New York, bringing my sponsor back who'd gotten drunk after he saved me in Washington, D.C., Jackie Williams, I met Bill and Hank Parkhurst, who was number two man in New York. At that time, we were just 2 months out of the Oxford Group. Is where Bill got his original upbringing and education. But I'd like to tell you a little story I told at our group of Bill's last drunk, which gives you an insight. I'll give it as quick as I can, so it won't take up too much time. He was on his way to a golf course, and he met the stranger on the bus. And he started telling that he found out he was an alcoholic, that he couldn't handle alcohol, that he'd been in town's hospital for the third time that year. This was in November 1934. And told him that this doctor had told him that it is obsession of the mind plus an allergy. That, in his opinion, or any place that you've ever seen, nobody's ever been able to drink again once that had set in, had become an alcoholic. And he'd been pronounced by Dr. Silkworth at town's hospital as an incurable alcoholic. Of course, all alcoholics are incurable now, we realize that. So he was talking to this guy on the bus. They stopped off for lunch in this bar grill, and they were having a sandwich, and it was Armistice Day, and the bartender said, drink from the house for everybody. And they put a shot down at everybody's table. And Bill, in his talking way, picked it up and knocked it off. And the stranger said, man, Mr. Wilson, you must be crazy. You've just told me the story about you being in the hospital, that you're incurable, alcoholic, and there you are taking a drink. And Bill said, I guess I am crazy. I think that was one of the first steps. But the spark of this fellowship was struck 2 or 3 weeks later when he came out of towns again, or rather he was on his way to towns. And this boyhood friend of his, a fellow named Eddie, came to see him. He'd been a drunk very much similar to Bill. And he told Bill, he said, Bill, I'm not drinking anymore. I joined the Oxford Group. And I found out that it's me that is all mixed up. That if I change my thinking, clean up my background, make restitution, help others, that I'll stop drinking and stay stopped. And I'm happy. And Bill tells the story. He said, well, this guy's gone wacky on religion now. So he went on into the towns, continued his drinking. And while he was in towns, he heard Dr. Silkworth talking to Lois at the door. He says, I think it's too late. I don't think you'll ever come out of this hospital without going to an asylum of some sort. He's gone too far. Bill just happened to remember that a little bit. And the way he tells it, all of a sudden, he felt this wind blowing him. He said, if there is a God, he'd been a terrific agnostic like so many of us had been, if there is a God, please have him show himself. And he felt this wind going through him. And he rang for Dr. Silkworth. And the good doctor came in. This story is the doctor's story in the book. And he said, Doc, don't think I'll drink anymore. I've had some sort of a revelation of some sort. I can't explain it. But I don't seem to have this weight on me anymore. And Silkworth said, she asked Silkworth, am I going crazy? And Silkworth, waiting a little bit later, he said he shook his head. He thought, well, the guy has really gone over the border. But he said, Bill, I don't know what it is you may have, but I think it's better than what you've had. Try to hold on to it. And Bill never had another drink. It would be nice to say that Eddie, that brought the message, stayed sober. But he was drunk a couple of months later, and he died of alcoholism, in and out of AA, over a period of about 32 or 3 years. He became quite a pain in the neck to quite a few of us. So you see, this thing comes from everywhere. So for 6 months, Bill daily made calls at Towns Hospital, and other drunks coming through there. He got mixed up in the Oxford group and tried to find the drunks that were in there to try to tell them, and nothing happened. Nobody stayed sober. He took them home. He had 75 of them over a period of time at home there. Not a one of them stayed sober. One of them committed suicide. One of them almost burnt the house down. He was trying to do it himself, as a good doctor told him later. Now, when Eddie saw Bill this time, he quoted one of the greatest psychiatrists in the country, Carl Jung, who inherited Freud's business sort of after he left in Switzerland. And this Eddie had been over there for psychiatric treatment to be cured of his drinking. And Carl Jung had told him, Dr. Carl Jung, this eminent psychiatrist, said, Mr. Thatcher, people like you will never stop drinking. I've seen a few isolated cases where they had a religious awakening, upheaval, or conversion, if you wish. But I doubt if you are ready for that. He says that has been very, very unusual. You see, the time AA got started, or even when the book came out, nobody knew that once a drunk, always a drunk. That was the common expression that everybody had. It's true, there wasn't anything to do. Just put them in the closet and lock them away or do the best you can. And this program has been one of the things that's helped open up this door. My opinion is that Bill will go down in history as a pastor of alcoholism. He'd be ranked in history, in my estimation, with John Salk, who's done so much for polio here in our own city. Because nothing was done. So after 6 months, sobering up nobody, he finally got a little opportunity. He'd been in Wall Street before the crash. He'd been a syndicate man. That's one of these guys, a snoop for a syndicate of operators for a good thing to push. And he was pretty good. He probably made paper millions, I don't know. It was a great deal. Of course, the crash took it off. So he had this opportunity after 6 months to go to Akron or a business there that would have made him independent for life if he'd been able to put this proxy deal over. But it flopped. And he was over there away from everybody. And he was in the Mayflower Hotel. And he tells the story of walking back and forwards in the lobby, hearing the music in the bar, thinking of the days in the Army, when the boys, he was a second lieutenant, he always bragged about the boys in his platoon, had chipped together and gotten him this watch. And he began to think of the fun he had at that time. Then he thought, my God, I can't go crazy again. So he saw this directory of ministers. And through that, he got a hold of an Oxford grouper. And it happened that this Oxford grouper had been working on a drunken surgeon named Bob Smith without any luck. This is on Mother's Day in 1935, in May. So he goes out to see the good doctor with this Oxford grouper, and the doctor wasn't there, but he came in later with a potted plant, as Bill tells it, very well potted. So they bedded him down, and Bill starts talking to him. And he started telling about himself. And he started telling about his experience at Towns. And how he had this revelation. We always called it a New York group in those early days, Bill's Hot Flash. But whatever it was, it worked. So Bob Smith thought this was a wonderful idea. But he had to go to a convention, a medical convention, the following week down Atlantic City. And he goes down, and he gets well potted again. So the word came back by telegram to meet the train. Bill took him off, stayed with him there for a month or two, and Bob never had another drink until he died. 16 years later, in 1951. Just think of that. Those two men got together, sharing. All they were doing was sharing what everybody else had told them about themselves. But here it was sharing on an even basis. No look down. No telling the other guy you got to do anything. It was on an even Stephen basis. Bill said, the only reason I came to see you, Bob Smith, is because I might have gotten drunk. Now that I'm here, I'm glad we see something together. But just think, those two men, that was in 1935, thousands get drunk and die in these 35 years. There are 15,000 AA groups in the world, practically every country. It's probably the largest mass of groups any place, anywhere. Of course, they're like floating crap games. They're here and gone and changing, but they're sobering up drunk. So they went along. Bill came back. And they made one more call while Bill was there on a lawyer in Akron, Bill Dodson. And he was up scrapping and a damn good attorney. But when these people were taking the time up and not knowing him to give him this message of recovery, that they were doing something about it, and when he joined, he became, this is a month after Bob Smith, he became sober immediately and never drank until he died about 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So that was a terrific start there. Then Bill comes back to New York, and he goes to town, he goes to the Oxford Group, and after about 3 or 4 years, when I came in, 3 years from his last drink, I came in. When I came in to the New York Group, we had Bill sober 3 years. We had Hank Parker sober 2 years. We had Fitz Mayo, the guy that was responsible for me, really, 1 year. That's all we had. After 4 years in the Oxford Group, sober over a year. But we were authorities. We had them going and coming. So when we broke away from the Oxford Group in New York, which we did at the end of 1937, just 2 months before I came in, that's what we had. And in Akron, they had about 12 people coming to Bill's house every Tuesday night. We would sit around in a circle, and Bill would be in the center with a little footstool, three-legged footstool. And he used to use that as a symbol that this fellowship that was starting stood on three legs, medicine, psychology, and spirituality. And that was AA, those three legs. He'd read a few books, not very deeply. So about this time, 2 or 3 months after I'd been in, only 4 or 20 stayed sober. That's one of the reasons I had changed the business, the matter of the book. So anyway, we decided we'd have a vote, Akron in New York, whether to have this pamphlet or not. And here's another thing, how this thing works in mysterious ways. The vote came out 11 to 10 to have a pamphlet. 11 to 10. The Akron boys wanted to stay in the Oxford Group, most of them. They wanted to keep it word to mouth. They couldn't see the drunks on the outside. In 38, we thought there were only 50,000 drunks in the country. They were unknown, they were hidden, they were under the carpet. We went to Bellevue. Sure, they had alcoholics. They cured a lot of them. They were drinking beer now and not having any trouble. But they didn't have any complete case histories to prove it. We found out later. So that first pamphlet was Bill's story, Bob's story, and Dr. Sifler's story. Those three stories are still in the AA book. And Parker said, well, this is wonderful. I have a friend of mine who reads Digest. He'll go for this. So we went to Reader's Digest, he did, he and Bill. And Reader's Digest says, yes, you throw us out in the full novel, and we'll run it after it's been published some other place. We'll digest it for you. So so we go to the best, Hopper's. And Hopper says, yep, we'll do this for you. We'll take the publishing over. And we'll give you $3,000 in royalties enough to keep them living. We were all broke. We were all without jobs. There wasn't an automobile in the New York group. And they brought that story back to the New York group. Harper thinks it's all right. They'll give us $3,000. And Hank prays, if it's worth $3,000 to them, it's worth $1 million to us. Immediately, we lost a great deal of that spirituality. We got a bit commercial. $1 million, couple dozen of us, big job. See, the idea was, at the time of the publishing of the book, even in 39, a year later, we thought the knowledge of the incurability of alcoholism, this great information that we culled from these grunts, and the guy would get down on his knees immediately and no more booze. It was going to be that simple. We hadn't looked at the picture that we were in ourselves, both in Akron and New York. The only ones in the same circle were those who were holding on to each other and saw each other almost daily. In other words, we didn't know it was a group fellowship that helped us out those first few months and years we were in AA. So we start publishing books. Now here's something I want to tell you very frankly. Bill is the architect of this whole AA program. There's no other architect in it. He claims he was a referee. And boy, what a referee. He had got into a few of the fights. So he started writing this. A chapter at the time. A copy would go to Akron. A copy would go to our New York group. Double space. We'd comb it. Or I always like to say, by alcoholic lawyers. So the time it ended up, it didn't say you had to do a damn thing. But it gave suggestions. That if these are built this way, it seemed to have better to luck than the ones that built that away. In a sort of manner. So that's how the book happened to be run off. From June 38 to April 39 when it came out. We were having the meetings at Bill's house. They were having the meetings at Bob's house. They were still mixed very heavily in the Oxford group out there. And they were for a couple more years to come. But 1 year after we got this book together, instead of two groups in 39, when the book came out, Akron, New York, 1 year later, we had 125 groups throughout the United States and Canada, just from this book being passed around. And so, but we didn't sell the million copies we planned on. We actually sold 300 the first year. And each of us peddled it to bookshops or any place we could. The book was in hock. We could get it out for $2.50 and sell it for $3.50. The dollar would go to the New York office. Partially to help Bill. Incidentally, is one of the things that Burr didn't tell you. Nobody in AA at any time has drawn any salary or income from Alcoholics Anonymous. Still, over these years, you can say we leapfrogged it or whatever you wish. But Bill had to stay there and keep the store. Because the rest of us were wandering around, getting jobs, getting the wrinkles out. And he was the only one with the inspiration and the dogginess to do it. So he was getting a royalty of 50 cents a book for every AA book sold, for every AA tradition book sold. And that's been his income today. So he was a little bit outside, but we've kept it honest as far as we could. But I wanted to bring out a point of Bill's hard-headedness and perseverance. We met his mother right here when we came out here in 1946. And she told us a story about him that exemplifies it very well. He was a gangling guy in school. He couldn't go into athletics. And he had this terrific ego. He wanted to be the best of whatever it was. So he picked up a violin and became head of the band. They never had a band in the school before. Incidentally, I'd say, after hearing him after 50 years, his practicing, he wasn't as good as Benny on his worst day. You agree with that? But anyway, then another very good expect. There's a story she told us about Bill going to his grandpappy where he's living with him up in Vermont, about 12. And he says, I want to make a boomerang. And grandpappy said, the only people that make boomerangs are Zulus or whoever makes them. And they have a trick. So Bill just didn't say anything about it. And they saw him carving for months and months and months. He'd taken out one of the bedsteads, slats, and he carved this thing out. Finally, he called his mother and grandpappy out, and he threw this thing, and damn near took the old man's head off. But it worked. He made a boomerang. He figured he was the first person out of the Zulus or whatever they were to make a boomerang. But that is dogged. But there were so many things. When we lost our spirituality, it became commercial. That's where we learned about traditions. In 40, 41, and 2, Bill and Bob Smith broke their anonymity all over the lot. So did any of us, any place. Anonymity was for the new person. And we were also falling down on our faces. Norman Brokenshaw wrote a very popular song, how he'd been cured of alcoholism and by AA. And he was the greatest radio announcer in the 20s and 30s. And Brokenshaw ended up drunk and died a couple of years later. We had another guy who wanted to open up an AA hospital. He did, in Missouri. He said it was cruel to put the drunk on cold turkey. This is back 41, too. So they should be tapered off. So he's got a great big building. And on the third floor, he had these drunks laying in there. And he'd be tapering them off. The last guy to taper would be the guy to taper the next guy. Well, it sounds good on paper. Then the second, after a week or so, they came to the second floor. And then the first floor, where the AA meeting, and the slot machines, which was supporting this way. Well, of course, that was another thing that went. But those are some of the things that happened. Then we began to have AA, Catholic AAs, Protestant AAs. Then another guy wanted to run a radio program. He had an Indian insurance company, and he would run it. And he was going to get this royalties. with all the good intentions in the world. He also got drunk. Thank God, before the total meeting got out. We had no hold on him. The book wasn't even copywritten. The book wasn't even copywritten until 1955. We were operating for 15, 16 years with a book anybody could have stolen. Or label. But the time when traditions came in, as Bert told you about, Bird. We also had another thing that made a terrific help. The grapevine was started about the same time in 45. And they became the positive voice of AA. And you all know what that's doing for us now. It's a terrific, particularly for loners, or people away, or people that want to pick up an AA meeting alone. But those are some of the things. Now here's something else that Barry didn't tell you, I don't believe. He mentioned the Sardine Post. When they went down to Philadelphia to make the deal, they said, sure, we'd love to run the article. And they gave us Jack Alexander. Well, Jack Alexander had just busted the Hines case in New York, the political case, and he was considered the racket buster. And they were after the Oxford group. And this AA thing was mixed up with Oxford, so they came in to expose this fellowship as being a phony deal. And Bill said to Jack, says, please, before you put anything down, please visit a half a dozen neat groups. And Jack did. And that was the greatest article he ever wrote. It sold more Sardine Post than any article previous to that. There were 12,000 inquiries for help. One shape or form. And we all had to do it. What we do, I was in Philadelphia at that time. I left the New York group and helped to start the Philly one. And we would get these letters from New York, and we would contact them and get these people together. And that same thing was done all over the country and Canada. And that's how our group started up. That's how we became 100 groups instead of 2 after 1 year. That became the proof. Then the thing that almost killed Bill was out here in 43, the boys in L.A. had picked up a pot of $1,200, sent it to Bill for Ian Rice to come out and visit him and to hit the other groups at this area. So that was the first time that Bill, or anybody who was in AA or in the fellowship, had been on the list. And when he came out here, he saw in 43, he saw a better organized group in LA than they had in New York, with no help from New York. They were the first ones to lift the 12 steps out of the book and make them apostle, or the fifth chapter. He found the same situation in San Francisco. We were struggling here a little bit. But when he got back from that trip, that damn near killed him. Here he was, done all this work, and no appreciation. Here these goddamn drunks were getting dry by themselves. They didn't need any help. And it was a blow to his ego. Dr. Silkworth always said of Bill, said, you have the greatest ego of any man I've ever seen, covered with a veneer of humility. He didn't know that was true of all of us. I'm going over time, but I'm going to take five more, three or four more minutes. But, so for about 2 years, he was in this terrible depression. And he would go to the New York office, and he'd hear these gripes from all over the country. He never heard anything good. There was always these so-and-sos back home there, they're doing this and that. Phil, tell them what to do, and straighten them out. So Bill didn't have a real true picture of the strength of this fellowship in those early days. So once he got the idea of the tradition, then he forged ahead again. He's always a guy, if you give him a project, he's the driver. But if his project is completed, like most drunks, we fold it up. That's why he was so worried. I called him at Christmas time. Luckily, I had a chance to talk to him. And he said, Jimmy, how's things going? Any trouble this day? I said, for God's sake, Bill, there's nothing to worry about in the AA fellowship. They don't need any of us old timers. The traditions are well instilled. Nobody's going to run away with a bunch of drunks. And we have one great big stick that no other fellowship has. We have something that nobody else has that'll bring these guys back in shape. That's John Valatron. So all we got to do is let the power drivers leave them alone. Well, you can't change them, or us, or me, or anybody else. They've got to find this thing themselves. So, thousands have died because they couldn't take the steps. But there's millions that don't know. Last report, 9 million. Over 90% of them are in the white collar class. Another 7 to 8% is in the working class. And less than 2% are transient skid rows. But 9 million. But we have scratched the surface. In my humble opinion, I think that we have educated well over 1 million drunks. Whether they stop or not, we don't know. But that's our only job, is to offer, if they reach, or if they ask, and to be there. That's why I know I'm not important anymore. I never was. But this thing is so deeply, it's such a wonderful experience to go to my little group in Mission Hill and to see these people coming in, getting on their feet. No matter how badly I feel when I get there, I come home refreshed. God, I never had such an opportunity. And thank God I did get this chance to be him in the beginning of the bookkeeping that have been active since the book. I happen to be the only one left. But I hope I'll be in there still working when you all come and get me. Thanks.